You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, welcome. Revolutionaries, you're back. We've got another week. And look at, you know what? And it's another powerhouse guest. Oh my goodness. Last week we were graced with USAID speechwriter and communications director Christina Dry. If you missed that episode, you really don't want to. Some of the stuff that she talked about, being in the room when those DOGE agents, the brown shirts, as I call them, were going through the USAID building and just hearing what that experience was like, and as the first agency that really came under the gun of the Trump administration, it was so eye opening. And if I know we had some issues with like Spotify and all that kind of stuff, but I believe they're all live and you can listen to them. Go to civicmedia.us and you can listen to them there. But that really, really was an incredible interview. And not by me, of course, but by Christina Dry, because she is really amazing. But this week, I've got some more amazing people. And they are going to help sort through what the Trump administration is doing to decimate our local farmers, because that's a big deal. I am joined by Xochitl Torres-Small, who is the former Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, serving under President Joe Biden. What is going on?
It's so great to be here. Hi from New Mexico.
Oh, and just man.
Really glad to have a chat.
And it's such an honor that you're here, and I am so grateful for that. And also joining me to help me, because this is not my area of expertise, is my friend, seventh generation progressive dairy farmer, expert, consultant, and all-around good guy, Mr. Daniel Olson.
Hey,
what's up?
Good to be here.
Thank you for coming. Fun fact, we had a snafu, and I am so glad that he is here. We had a couple weeks ago a scheduling mess up by me, and I'm so glad that he's here. So, all right, Xochitl, you worked under President Joe Biden. You were the leader, of the organization. What was that like?
It was such an honor to get to work at USDA. I started out as Undersecretary for Rural Development, and then about a year and a half in, got tapped to serve as Deputy Secretary, which is really in charge of the back end. If you're thinking about it, it's kind of like, if you've got the President and the Vice President, it was the Secretary, Tom Vilsack, and then me as the Deputy Secretary, and in charge of things like hiring and permitting and IT. So a lot of the cuts that we're seeing now, I was in charge of trying to make that all work better as a government.
It's interesting because one of the talking points that's being said now is, oh, we're just trying to go back to 2019 staffing levels. Like, that's not true.
That's just not what's happening, and it's not strategic at all. I came from a rural district before serving at USDA. I was a member of Congress in one of the most rural districts in the country. It was the bottom half of New Mexico, and so when I came into the administration, I was really interested in how do we do things more efficiently? How do we make sure we're reaching rural places and with people in the administration who know rural places? So with those, I thought, there are some places where we could do things more efficiently. How can we use and leverage AI, for example, in a better way? Or how do we make sure we're supporting the state and regional offices at USDA to be able to have a closer connection to the countryside? But that's just not what's happening in this environment.
What are some of the things that that were goals that you guys had? You were Secretary Vilsack. What did you do that when you were in?
you know, when you look at USDA and you look at how we support farmers, we just know that it's crucial to make sure we're reaching all farmers. In the past, a lot of the subsidies have really been focused on and went to the largest operations. And the operations that are as efficient as possible, you know, it makes sense because we want to make sure we're feeding our country and feeding our world. But we've also got to support our small and mid-sized farmers. And that's what the Biden-Harris administration did. They worked to provide, expand programs that could reach any farmer, regardless of size, whether that's expanding the local markets by providing contracts to local farmers for regional schools or food banks, or whether that was helping add value to their crops or to their product through whether it's making milk, cheese, or butter, or whether it was using climate smart commodities to be able to access a whole new worldwide market.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that, you know, I see on your post, Daniel. Some of the stuff that you put out there is fascinating. Like, you talk about dairy farmers getting into how many kernels are on the corn that they. It's crazy. Like, it's really incredible, and how to fertilize sustainably, and how to, you know, like, that's the information there is so much bigger than what my brain can comprehend.
Well, there certainly is a lot of science involved in farming. And I think, you know, historically farmers have always been cutting edge, maybe they didn't always understand exactly why things happen, but they've always been progressive in that sense. And more so maybe in the past few decades, as margins have shrunk, as farms have maybe expanded and brought in more expertise, there just isn't the room for waste. And so on a farm level, farmers really understand optimization and technology, and have accepted that side of it fairly openly.
How do you think science in farming, and farmers really believe in science. How is it going to change with an administration that repeatedly has proven that they really don't like to believe in science?
Yeah, well, that's been my frustration. We saw that maybe when COVID came out. And there was this, you know, farmers have extensive vaccination protocol for their cattle starting on day one when they're born. That's the very first thing you do is you vaccinate calves. And yet we saw this real pushback and kind of an anti-science, and it was hard to rectify those two things. Mm. And like so many things in this world today, people's responses are based more on their political leanings versus maybe what they would have said to be right. And we see that even when it comes to trade or other things now, how quickly talking points pivot based on whatever maybe the president says or whatever the popular thing is to do today.
One of the things that I think is cool about you, Sachil, is you were elected as a moderate. Yeah, you were a Democrat, but you were elected as a moderate. You have tons of rural, you talked about that in your district. And so, you know, you had no time for like polarity or anything. You just had to get stuff done, right? What is happening right now?
Oh, I mean, just things aren't getting done. So, you know, you think about some of the things that I worked on in the last year or so. One of it was modernizing our IT department, trying to get people with current skills, whether it was AI or better use of robotic processing, for example, into the department. And so a lot of those were the probationary employees who were hired. And now just the level of uncertainty, the whiplash of, well, you're being let go. Oh, no, actually, you're staying on. Or, I mean, one, you know, they are firing people without cause is what it comes down to. But two, even if they're not yet terminated, because the courts come back and say that it's not allowable, there's so much uncertainty. People don't want to work in that environment. So we're going to lose our best and brightest.
Yeah, and I want to ask about the uncertainty from an administration and an organizational standpoint, and then I want to ask about uncertainty from to a, what is the farmer going to think?
Yeah.
So from an organization, I just saw, was it 2 days ago, where the USDA had to hire back like 6,000 people. And who's going to want, number one, who's going to want to come back and be like, yeah, sign me back up for that. What, how is this making sense? What is being affected? What parts of the USDA?
Well, I mean, all over. So if you look at the Forest Service, which is part of USDA, they had over 3,000, I believe, employees who were originally terminated. And that's people all over the country. Or if you look at rural development, my former mission area, there was an incredible effort to rehire people in the state and local offices. So these are folks where if you are a part-time clerk and you're trying to get funding for your water system, or if you are a farmer trying to get a REAP grant, which is to get renewable energy on site on your farm to help drive down your energy costs, the people that you were working with every single day that you were talking to, many of those were let go. So there, it's just the folks that you rely on to get a lot of the access to the support that farmers and people all across rural America deserve.
What type of like day-to-day interaction would farmers have with the USDA?
Well, yeah. So if you're paying your FSA loan, for example, you're going to go in every year, every planting season to apply for that. You're going to make your payments with these people. If you're applying for an NRCS cooperative agreement, so whether that's an irrigation system, whether that's a high tunnel, whether that's any number of programs, you're relying on them to help put together that plan. If you're working on high-speed internet applications, right, there was enormous investment in the Biden-Harris administration for high-speed internet, as well as reliable, affordable, clean energy in rural electric cooperatives. You were working with those engineers and those people who help process the applications and then provide the reimbursement. And that's a whole nother side. And then lastly, you know, if you're going through a drought or if you're there's another disaster, those insurance payments are made by people at USDA. And so the timeliness of getting those payments out, that's all reliant on employees. And so there was no intent, there was no thought to how are we going to decrease the size of USDA. They just said, we're going to cut all probationary employees and look for any excuse to reduce anyone. And so that's hitting farmers, that's hitting rural people really hard.
It's interesting, you know, the cuts, they're not strategic. It's just drunken, you know, we're going to just hack and cut and all of that stuff. We have a fascinating discussion going on with former Deputy Secretary of Agriculture, Satchel Torres-Small, and my friend Daniel Olson. We're going to talk on the other side about how farmers are going to feel this uncertainty right on their doorstep here on The Rational Revolution. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back. At the Rational Revolution, I'm Mark Becker. We've got former Deputy Secretary of Agriculture, Satchel Torres-Small, my friend, big farmer guy, Daniel Olson. We were talking on the other side of the break about the organizational uncertainty and what people are feeling who are employees of USDA. Daniel, uncertainty is terrible for anybody, but farmers plan months and months and months out.
Exactly.
What is the uncertainty like for them?
So there's three main points, I think, that are really impacting farmers. And maybe we just talked about the USDA, and I think a lot of them maybe aren't going to realize the impact of that for a few months or maybe a few years. I was just on a call with the USDA Forage Research Center, which I do extensive work with in my consulting work and things, and they're just talking about the chaos that's happening there. I mean, it felt like a funeral on that call. and so that's something that long-term is going to impact farmers. But more short-term, there's two things. Right now, the markets are in huge upheaval. I primarily work with dairy farmers, but really almost anything, agriculture is the thing that's going to get hit immediately and very hard when it comes to tariffs and the trade war that we're taking on with really the whole world at the same time. And then and then immigration and labor. A large percentage of the cows that get milked in this country are milked by immigrant labor. And that uncertainty, that it's hard. It really is. And I think a lot of farmers maybe don't quite realize it yet until it actually affects them. But already cheese is down maybe 15% in the last month, the price. That we went from a projection of a very profitable 2025 to a basically farmers are going to lose money in 2025 unless something majorly changes. And that's just in the last month.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And you look at, you talk about markets, and from what I do know, it's not the stock market we're talking about, like commodities, right?
We're talking about commodity markets.
So, and that's something people don't see that.
Yeah.
You know, when you watch the news, they don't talk about, Wisconsin being such an agriculture state. I mean, when I drive to work, I drive past a really, really big dairy farm right on County C in Chase. Mm-hmm. And then I drive by a little mom and pop that have maybe a couple dozen head of cattle. And who's going to feel these first?
Yeah, well, there are some protections and some programs that have been there in place. There were some opportunities for taking out like margin insurance and marketing. But generally larger dairies are going to have maybe more solid marketing plans and they have more opportunities to do that. Whereas smaller farms maybe just don't have as many opportunities. So from that standpoint, yeah, I would imagine smaller dairies are going to be hit quicker, but everybody is going to be affected if this carries on more than 6 months or 12 months.
Satchel, I read an article where there was a farmer and he was quoted, we were talking about some of the political stuff. The farmer said, we're in such a state of shock. We don't even know how to respond to all this. We thought that this was sacred and really untouchable. Everyone thinks that all farmers voted for this, but we didn't vote for this. How out of the blue is all of this?
Oh, I mean, I think there were incredible just shocks to farmers all across the country. Heard from farmers who had their contracts just canceled. So, you asked who's going to feel this first. The first farmer is the one who had a signed contract with the government to repay, reimburse for certain expenditures, whether that was putting in drip irrigation or whether that was a award for solar on their farm. But even if it was to expand to a more local market, right? So providing food to a food pantry or to a local school, public school system. They had contracts already signed with the federal government, and yet those are not being paid. Those funds have been frozen. That's an immediate loss. And I also heard from young farmers who were part of a plan to help young farmers get better access to land, because it's one of the hardest things for starting up a new farm. And those programs have been cut. So all of this investment in the next generation, the future of farming, making sure we don't lose that crucial agricultural land, they're no longer going to be able to access that program. So a lot of things that were already planned and frankly already signed, you have the federal government reneging on that.
If a farm had a plan that was going to put some irrigation up, and when I was a county supervisor, I got to tour a farm field that had this, like, it was incredible drainage system that they had in Brown County. And they showed us how it was working with, you know, different roots during the winter time and all this. It was incredible. Mm-hmm. And so they get funds to be able to do that stuff. The contracts are done, the work is done, but they're not getting help that was promised.
The contract is done. They've already made the payment. So I've heard from one farmer who got funding for a high tunnel and drip irrigation, and they were out $13,000. They've already made that payment. They've now submitted receipts to the federal government, and that money is not being paid.
Yeah, I have. I was just on the phone before I walked in here to the studio with a company that does commercial, like drip irrigation, subsurface drip irrigation. And yeah, a number of their projects are stalled out. It's tough because they're trying to import, you know, supplies. They have to have supplies on place. These farms were wanting to get these projects installed before the crops go in the spring. Everything's in a holding pattern. Nobody really knows. Another client of mine in Ohio put in a large solar project, $400,000 out of pocket, and they have not gotten paid for that yet. These kind of things, it's just a lot of chaos and confusion and just uncertainty. And it didn't need to be this way. That's the frustrating part. Like you could have had a plan and said, yeah, we want to reduce the size. Let's work through the proper channels. Let's give it a 6 months, a year, 2 years to make that happen and work through an administration structure. And instead it just blew it up.
Just to that point, and meanwhile, the things that people were voting for, lower prices, that's not helping either, right? Eggs are still, I walked into our local Save Mart and, you know, for six eggs, it was $3.19 for six eggs. That used to be for a whole dozen. So you're seeing impact to the farmers and you're not seeing a change for consumers. In fact, with, as Daniel, as you mentioned, the impact to the market and with tariffs, we're going to see that increase even more. I mean, when you look at how much farmers rely on markets in Canada, Mexico, and China, those are our top three trade partners. And now, you know, there's just so much uncertainty every single day. But then also you look on the input side. One of the things the Biden-Harris administration did was invest in fertilizer production domestically. So how do we make sure that we have domestic production of fertilizers so that farmers have more reliable market, no matter what's happening in the world? And we learned that because after Russia attacked Ukraine, there were massive skyrocket of fertilizer prices. Now, unfortunately,
we're going to continue this discussion on the other side of the break. We've got Zachel Torres Small and Daniel Olson. We're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about tariffs and how what do we do going forward. So stick around. We're back on the Rational Revolution. We have former Deputy Secretary of Agriculture Zachel Torres Small. Thank you so much again for hanging out with us, and dairy farmer extraordinaire Daniel Olson, who works with 1 in 12.
Yes,
1 in 12 cows. That's crazy. We were talking a little bit about, you know, how these things didn't need to happen. We hit on tariffs. Did the Biden administration have anything close to what was going on with tariffs right now?
I mean, not at all. I mean, we were very focused on, especially in the ag, sector, expanding opportunities. So I mentioned that our top three trade partners right now are Mexico, Canada, and China. The Biden-Harris administration was focused on diversifying our markets. So making sure that we can sell to more countries. I led trade missions in Angola and in India, right? So these are opportunities to really expand our markets. And we're not seeing that same focus on how do we sell more in different places, but rather just how do we pick fights with anyone that we're already trading
with. Yeah, one thing that's wild is he talks about how, you know, whoever signed that last trade agreement was a moron, you know, but then doesn't point out that, well, Donald, that was you, you know, you did that. And now you're just throwing a bomb right on it. But I think, you know, a lot of what he's gearing towards and what he's hitting, you know, with tariffs and all of that, and initiatives of climate and immigration. I mean, like, what is going to be, what's going to hurt dairy farmers the most?
Where do you start? So like I said, there's the short-term things. Those are the market is the first thing. I mean, that's going to affect their milk checks next month. Like that, farmers, their ability to pay their bills and their suppliers, like that's going to happen now. And then there's the people, like we talked about, that have had grants and had innovative things, you know, whether it's anaerobic digesters or solar projects or things that were happening, infrastructure, things that were, you know, that many of them have spent a lot of money on already starting these projects that are maybe in limbo. And then of course, labor, and that's an issue. And the policy and the spirit around immigration and immigrant labor.
What are your farmers seeing with their labor force?
Yeah, so it's hard because right now the rhetoric doesn't really match up with the statistics. Like so far, I don't think we're seeing any more deportations than what maybe there was under the Biden administration on average. But there's these really kind of like in your face, like attacking people, you know, pulling them out of churches or schools or whatever, like it, so they want to give the perception of fear. And I think they're doing that. I remember back to the last time, the last Trump administration and ICE was coming into larger dairy farms and doing immigration checks. And one of my clients in Michigan, they actually gave them a 24-hour notice and they told the farm, hey, we're going to be there. We want to go through all your immigration, your paperwork. And the farm felt like their employees were all legal, and they let them know, hey, just heads up, we're going to be here tomorrow. We're going through things. Just wanted to let you know what's happening. And the next morning, nobody showed up. So, okay, 30-some employees, 3,000 cows, and the farms out there trying to get their friends and neighbors to milk these cows, because none of their employees were there. And I don't know if their employees were legal or not. I really don't know. I mean, the farm doesn't know. But the fact is, there wasn't the confidence in the federal government that even if we are legal, even if all our things are straight, that they're still not going to arrest us. And I think that's what we're seeing right now.
Sacha, we look at in politics or in life in general, relationships matter. And with these tariffs, how we're punching our best friends straight in the face. We have representatives and the president and all that saying, well, just trust us. In the long run, this is good. Maybe it's just me, but I see in the long run, people are going to be really pissed at us. And the damage that we're doing now is going to bite us for a long time.
Yeah, I'll get to that, but first I want to go back to the labor piece real quick.
Please.
Because you know, when you're operating a dairy, Daniel knows this, right? 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, when employees are afraid to show up, that completely puts a wrench in your entire system, right? And so you're relying on that labor force. The Biden administration was working to find ways to expand the H-2A system, which is the not for dairies yet, although there is a legislation in Congress that would provide access to H-2A for dairies. But to make sure that farmers had access to that reliable, documented labor. And I heard from a farmer who received an award to invest in some H-2A laborers, who's going to have to now potentially lay off two of their workers because that contract was paused too. So you talk about those immediate impacts. They are not helping address the labor crisis in agriculture. They are scaring families, people who are documented, but maybe they have TPP status, and he's threatening that for Venezuelans. I mean, you just see across the board, again, that confusion. And that's what causes fear for immigrant families who are just trying to work hard and support our ag economy. When it comes to trade and relationships, one thing I saw on the ground, so people may not know this, but there's USDA workers all across the globe working to advance trade deals in every single country. And well, in every country where we have relationships with. And one of the biggest barriers is all of the paperwork on the other side when they get to the country. And that relies so much on relationships and trust to help drive down the enforcement of the agreements that are made. And what Trump is doing now is just breaking up those relationships, so no one's going to trust us in the future. So it's not just about what trade negotiation deal do you have, but how much real access do you have to sell in a country? And if they don't trust us, they're not providing that access.
Well, what's crazy is, you know, we can have these tit for tat on, you know, things like, oh, we're going to tariff your bourbon from the United States. Oh, yeah. Suck on that champagne. How's that? You know, well, now it's like wheat, you know, and we had Christina Dry talking about how USAID would buy tons of food from farmers, and it's now sitting in warehouses rotting. There's schools and farmers that are now like, we would sell right to our local schools. And that was something that and that's gone. And all of these things that they relied on, all this storm of uncertainty, that decimates the whole ecosphere of what's going on.
Well, and when you look at our trade deficit in ag, and this is something that Trump said he was really concerned about and said that he was going to turn that around. Well, part of the reason for that trade deficit is those high end products like bourbon, right? Mm-hmm. So liquor is part of the ag trade economy now. And because they're high end, it has a large space. So one of the challenges is that people now in the U.S. who have a higher purchase power are going into the shops and buying tequila and buying, other things. And that drives up the trade deficit. So one of the strategies from the Biden-Harris administration was, how do we export more high-end products that are made in the U.S., that are grown in the U.S. and processed in the U.S.? And now those are the exact places where other countries are targeting to limit exports. So saying we're not going to import bourbon, for example. Right. So it's just going to it's going to further exacerbate our trade deficit.
What can farmers do to protect themselves, you know, and to keep their farms going through this hurricane, you know?
Yeah, well, I wish I knew how long this hurricane is going to last. You know, that's the issue. Is this a 2 month of uncertainty? Is it 6 months? Is it 4 years? Is it 8 years? What is that? And that's a big thing. Like, I don't know. The issue, once again, I'm speaking from a dairy side of things, is roughly 18% of our dairy products are exported.
Really?
And so we're in an industry that's...
They rely on it.
We do. And there's this exponential curve. When you lose a few percent on the market, it can weigh maybe 15 or 20% on the domestic price. So there's this exponential curve of supply and demand. And that's an issue. When you lose out on even just a few percent, it's not 2% of the price. It's maybe 15 or 20%. And so how we improve or how we survive, I mean, that is, a lot of farms are going to go into survival mode, which means we're not making capital investments. We're not growing. We're just going to try to survive. And that's not healthy long-term for any business to be in.
Yeah, that was Daniel Olson here. We're also talking with former Deputy Secretary of Agriculture, easy for me to say, Satchel Torres-Small. What are you up to these days? So, I mean, you know, you're not in the Biden administration anymore, unfortunately. What are you doing?
Well, right now, I'm just real glad to be back home. It's been about 7 years on and off having to schlep it to D.C. And it was a long time away from my husband. So I just came back from I taught at a fellowship at the Institute of Politics in Chicago and to meet some really neat kids. I was there with former Senator Tester. So we've
had
a lot of conversations. Cool. It was a good way to just check in with students about what they're thinking for the future, but also make sure that they are thinking about agriculture and how big a part of it is of everybody's life, not just farmers, because all of us eat every single day. And so making sure that people respect the hard work that farmers do, they understand what a crucial part of our economy it is, and why making sure that whether you're a small, mid, or large size farm, we all are dependent on their future.
Yeah, right. No kidding. How many vacations do farmers get typically?
That's hard to say.
Daniel, he laughs. He's like, nah, not a lot. that's the thing that's so frustrating is, you know, we can sit back and, you know, shrug our shoulder. I don't think 95% of people really understand how difficult it is to do that. And when I see some of the posts that you put, you know, on Facebook, and, mm-hmm. and they are fascinating, talk about how minute of the margins are that farmers have to live in. And then when we have a swing of 15% in a 2-month span, that's horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, most farmers aren't doing it for the money.
You know? Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
You're doing it because you're passionate about what you do. There's this generational thing. Many farms are multi-generational. I'm the seventh generation on our family farm and have a bunch of kids coming on, so we'll see what happens. But that's so there's, you do it because you enjoy it, because you love it. And the problem is on days like today, in these kind of situations, it takes a lot of the joy out of it. That right. uncertainty, that added layer of stress. I saw one of my friend that on Facebook this morning just was really vulnerable and talking about you know, depression and anxiety and just uncertainty and how it's affecting him. And you know, depending what size of farm you are and whatever, but you said this already, you just can't take days off. I mean, the cows still need milk 2 or 3 times a day, you know, everything. And when you talk about mental health, anxiety, uncertainty, financial stress, and all those things kind of piling on. Yeah, I'm very concerned about farmers' well-being.
We got 30 seconds here with Zachiel Torres-Small, former Deputy Secretary of Agriculture. What do we got for final thoughts? How do we make sense of this?
I mean, I think the real words that I've heard are chaos and uncertainty. And farmers are some of the clearest planners. They are thinking ahead, and it's impossible to do that right now. And so as we look towards continued CR negotiations, the massive cuts to veterans and other programs that we expect to see through the CR, then we look at the budget and the $880 billion that we're trying to figure out how to cut, the $230 billion. It's just we're looking at massive cuts for farmers. We have to figure out how to address it.
Zachiel Torres-Small, I really hope we get to have you back again, because this was a blast and you are so full of information. Daniel Olson, thank you so very much for tuning in, and we'll be back after this. Thanks, guys.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back. My goodness. You know, I feel like I need a cigarette after that conversation. That was a... That was a lot, you know, and it's, I love learning about that kind of, I mean, not, I don't love learning about the horrible things that are happening, but it certainly was eye-opening to speak with my friend and seventh generation family farmer and consultant to dairy farmers all over the world, Daniel Olson, and former Deputy Secretary of the USDA, Zachiel Torres-Small. Wonderful people, and I hope they both come back, because I'd love to talk to them, you know, about how this is all playing out. Cause I struggle to see the light on the edges here. And it's not, there's so much darkness. And, I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. Sorry guys, but I'm going to dedicate this segment to, my local representative here in Congress. This guy named Tony Weed. And there's a great meme going around, and it's got the picture of like, where's Waldo? And it says, where's Weed? Well, we found him. And I want to tell you what we found him doing. I first want to recognize something that's a hard fact. It's not a particularly nice one, but it is true. Tony Weed did not get the Republican nomination here locally because of his political skill or his business success or his ability to articulate the issues or connect with voters or his deep connection, quite frankly, to the local community itself. Tony Weed got the nomination because he was knighted Trump-endorsed Tony Weed before the primary. He defeated one. I'll say I don't want to give Andre Jacques that much credit, but he defeated a guy that was a military veteran, former state senator, and he won that primary not because of who he was, but because he was blessed by the almighty Trump. And it's important to know that because it kind of explains what he's been doing since. Wisconsin is like the swingiest of swing states, right? You got the blue wall, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. But, you know, Wisconsin is the closest to 50-50 of all of them. Yet, we somehow have two Democrats out of eight people that we send to Washington. And as Ben Wickler said, you know, he said this, we're not sending our best. Well, Tony Weed, I believe, is a shining example of that. He's certainly not our best. Tony Weed in Washington is representing his own self-interests instead of representing the interests of the people of the 8th Congressional District. How, you may ask? Well, it's in Tony Weed's best interest to shut up and get in line. It's in his interest not to question the dear leader and to just go along with everything like he does, regardless of the harm that it inflicts on people in his district. Like we heard earlier in the show, they talked about it. Farmers, Trump is hurting us. And Tony Weed does not care. He is blindly spewing regime talking points and gushing over the fearless leaders in ways that would make everyone's eyes just roll out of the back of their heads, right? For example, during one of his appearances on the far right News Nation network, this was before Trump's address to Congress, Tony Weed praised Donald Trump's tariffs, saying they're in our best interest. He said that dramatic increases in prices across the spectrum, goods, services, all of it is in our best interest. And I got a flashback. It's like an abuser, you know, causing everyone pain and then telling us to shut up and take it. It's in your best interest. This is good for you. It's not good. He praised Donald Trump's relationship with Elon Musk, saying that he knows how to find talent. And he glossed over the fact that Doge is literally doing Congress's job. Congress is the holder of the purse strings. And they're doing it, usurping everything. He said, Congress hasn't done a very good job, so I'm fine with Elon's work. What? What? You are fine with taking the power and the authority that the people of the 8th Congressional District gave to you, Tony Weed, handing it on a platter, and you take it and give it to an unelected world's richest man that doesn't give a crap about Northeast Wisconsin. You, Tony Weed, who profess, don't tread on me, limited government, get government all out of our lives, all of that stuff. And you are okay with the world's richest man and his army of brown shirts having access to our most personal information. You're okay with that? You're totally cool with them having our freaking social security numbers, my kids' social security numbers and tax information. Tony Weed, I am not okay with that. He went on to gaslight everyone that was watching on that interview, saying stupid stuff like, he was the most transparent candidate for president in the history of the country, and everybody knows that. Shut up. No, you're wrong. Not everybody knows that. You fawn all over him like it's unflattering. Well, in this past week, Tony Where's Weed Waldo finally addressed his constituents, sort of. He held a teletown hall where Tom Tiffany did most of the talking. The event began with a mystery host reminding everyone that this is an interactive forum and we'd love to hear from you this evening. And then all the wild guests and questioners were pre-screened and pre-selected, giving the feigned appearance of being transparent, all while not actually having to be transparent. It was, in true Trump style, a fraud. Here's the thing. We found Tony Weed, and what we've found isn't very pretty. Tony Weed and the Republicans were gift-wrapped on a silver platter, an economy that was on the verge of a powder keg, and all they had to do was lower inflation just a little bit, and the power and the might of the American consumer was going to do the rest. But not even 60 days later, we're talking about a recession. Tony, what the hell are you doing? And people have a right to have that answer. But instead, you are being a coward and hiding from the very people that you represent. It is ridiculous. And Tony Weed, in my opinion, has been found uncaring, unimpressive, and completely unfit to represent the people of Northeast Wisconsin. It is ridiculous that someone in that role would take that responsibility with such a lack of sincerity. We all deserve better, and it is up to us to vote better. Hey, thanks for sticking around. Thanks for listening to me blather on. It's good to have Todd the God behind the glass one more time. Thank you, Zacho Torres Small, Daniel Olson. We'll see you next week.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.